Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 11th day of August. It is 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Radio, the theater of the mind. And yet, while we can't see you, we can certainly feel your presence. And we know it is solid and voluminous. And hopefully you had a lovely, lovely weekend. The weather was perfect. It just does not seem it could have been lovelier. I don't know if I think I'm speaking for the entire region. I don't believe there were pockets of the region that had bad weather. So hopefully you enjoyed it. You enjoyed a little taste of summer and what that was like, and are ready to come back and deal with the realities of what is going on in our world, and that's where we come in. We welcome you to be a part of the conversation, as always. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. We will go to those letters a little later on. Keep them short, to the point, that way we can get to as many as possible. Let me introduce the group to you. Senior fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Joe. Delighted to be here with you.
Very nice to have you here, as always. We also welcome Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Dr. Karen Riedel is here. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
Good morning. Very happy to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. And last but certainly not least, and I shouldn't have waited so long for her introduction. I should have introduced her first because she's been waiting in the green room for over an hour. But will you please welcome? just walked in the door. Libby Post is here.
Hi. Yes, I just walked in the door.
It's good. Well, but you made it. You made it. I mean, before I said welcome, Libby, you made it. You are on time.
Right. Well, if you had said where's Libby first, then I wouldn't have.
No. I wouldn't have done that
so
to you.
I knew.
I trust you. I knew you were going to be in on time. Libby Post is here, and political consultant, lobbyist, and our dear friend, and we thank you all for being with us on this Monday morning. Okay, so let's talk. As I mentioned, we would start off with Gaza. I don't know if I mentioned that to the audience at large, but I mentioned it to the folks in this room, except for Libby.
No, that's all right.
Who wasn't here?
Who was a late arrival, but that's all right.
I just heard you, though.
You know what? You'll catch up quick.
Yeah,
I know you will.
Yeah.
This won't be an issue. All right, one second. I have to log into my New York Times account. I noticed this is an odd thing, but I know a lot of you do Wordle in the morning. I do Wordle in the evening before I go to bed. It's sort of a palate cleanser to the day. And so the last couple of days I've gone on to Wordle, and it said, congratulations on being a great Wordler.
is that what they call
you
it?
Did a great job today. Come back tomorrow. And I think, well, somebody is doing Wordle on my account. So I very smartly decide that I'm going to change my password.
Oh.
Yeah, well, that's not good. Because now I can't really get into
I have to tell you, somebody hacked into our Peacock account.
Oh, dear.
Because I got this thing. Somebody, you know, from East wherever in New York, not Albany or Menance. And so I had to go in and change my username and, well, my password. You know, it's just like,
yeah, I hate it.
Some people
happens.
Have way too much time on their hands. That's all I have to say.
and then you end up watching. Well, were you okay? You got into Peacock?
Oh, sure. We got into Peacock, and we're instead of watching, I read the news. I just want to make that clear. I read the news. But instead of watching it, because I don't want to see the Orange Menace, right? We've been watching, and Lynn's going to kill me for this. We've been watching Project Runway from the beginning all the way through. And we're on season 18, I think.
Oh,
and
wow.
We started this the day of the inauguration. And so, yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah.
And it's mindless, and it just makes it a little easier to deal with everything else.
My Peacock show is Emergency.
Oh, yes. From the 1970s. I loved that when I was a kid. Yep.
And I'm almost done that. So, you know, we need these things to keep us going.
And there's a new Project Runway that came, they rebooted it on Disney.
Be Still My Heart.
Yeah, and it's a little weird, but what are you going to do?
All right. So here I have successfully logged in. Benjamin Netanyahu doubles down on Gaza offensive after global backlash. This is not the first time the Israeli prime minister has called for one final military drive to dismantle Hamas and end the war. Netanyahu defended on Sunday his government's plan to launch a renewed offensive against Hamas in parts of Gaza following a wave of international condemnation from traditional allies and critics at home. The Israeli military was prepared to expand its campaign to central Gaza as well as Gaza City. Mr. Netanyahu told reporters this at a news conference in Jerusalem. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have sought shelter in those areas, hoping they would be safer. Mr. Netanyahu's proposal has drawn fierce criticism from the families of Israeli hostages who fear their loved ones will be killed in the Israeli assault. The country's leaders also overruled the objections of Israeli military leaders who had raised concerns over the exhaustion among their soldiers. Given Hamas's refusal to lay down its arms, Israel has no choice but to finish the job and complete the defeat of Hamas, said Mr. Netanyahu. Dismantling the two remaining Hamas strongholds in Gaza City and the central camp and the central camps, this is the best way to end the war. On Friday, the Israeli government announced that the Security Cabinet, a group of senior ministers led by Mr. Netanyahu, had approved a plan for the military to prepare to take over and take control of Gaza City. Those preparations could take weeks, maybe months, potentially leaving open options for a diplomatic maneuver that would halt or reverse the military operation. But the decision quickly spurred anger abroad, where Israel is increasingly blamed for the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Aid agencies in European countries have blamed Israel and Israeli restrictions on aid, as well as a contentious new Israeli-backed relief distribution system for helping cause severe hunger in Gaza. One more thing before we go to the panelists. The UN Security Council met on Sunday in New York for a rare weekend gathering called by Britain, Denmark, Greece, France, Slovenia, in response to the Israeli announcement. Let's begin with Fred Hoff.
Well, Joe, let's hope there's some diplomatic maneuvering or whatever in the immediate future, because the sad irony of all this is that Israel has long since achieved the military objective of reducing Hamas to the point where it is no longer militarily capable of doing anything even close to what it did on October 7, 2023. And on that day, 1,200 Israeli Jews were killed for the crime of being Jewish. Israel had every right to go after the genocidal criminals who murdered and raped their way into Israel. But this horrific war of vengeance really should have ended months ago. It hasn't ended, mainly because Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been unable to end it on terms that would allow him to keep his job as prime minister indefinitely.
Correct.
He's under prosecution for corruption, and he wants to avoid accountability for why Israel was so unprepared nearly 2 years ago. He sees his best defense in terms of keeping his status as Israel's wartime leader. He thinks as long as he has that status, He's not going to be held accountable for anything. And this basically means the war must continue, which is a key demand of the right-wing extremists in his cabinet, on whom he relies to maintain a governing coalition. Bibi Netanyahu's proposal that the Gaza Strip be governed by something other than the Palestinian Authority, supported by Arab military forces, is a total non-starter. Arab states can see what's happening right in front of their eyes. And that is, as this brutal war in Gaza continues, the West Bank is step by step being annexed by Israel. These Arab states are not about to facilitate the death of Palestinian self-determination. Their publics won't allow them to do so. The role of the United States, I think, is critical in all this. President Trump has enormous leverage over Netanyahu. And Netanyahu fears that leverage. If President Trump wanted to, he could demand a ceasefire, the permanent withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, and the return of all hostages alive and dead. This would be Netanyahu's nightmare. He would have a basic choice.
So, yeah. If I may interrupt just for a moment, and I apologize, but the headline in the BBC today is that the U.S. shrugs off Gaza escalation, drifting further away from allies, and this would include the allies from Britain, Denmark, Greece, France, and Slovenia, who met at the U.N. last night.
Yeah, at this point, President Trump's inclination seems to be to facilitate, support Netanyahu's plans. This may be a function of his concentration on Ukraine at the moment. I mean, the president has indicated in recent days that he's seen people, Gazans, on TV who are obviously hungry. He says there's hunger going on. I think he realizes that this is a situation that simply cannot go on indefinitely. And his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is very active as we speak with the Qataris and the Egyptians, trying to come up with ceasefire terms. But, Joe, my bottom line in all of this is, regardless of how it turns out, this is a situation that's much bigger than the political and legal future of one person. This has been a horrible war in which unarmed civilians have paid the biggest price. And it's really got to end now. Every day that it continues is literally a crime against humanity. Israel has already won this war in terms of shrinking Hamas's military capabilities to the vanishing point. And I think there's no point to continuing a war in which unarmed civilians are simply inevitably on the bullseye.
Fred, I'm wondering what I could ask you about your insights on the changing mood within Israel, among Israelis, and the influence individuals in Israel actually can have on this administration, because it sort of seems disconnected from the general public and what the general public wants.
Yeah, Karen, I think it's kind of contradictory. Israeli polls show two things. First, most Israelis, 79%, according to the most recent poll, are not particularly moved by the enormous human suffering that's taking place in the Gaza Strip. Other polls show similar numbers, or at least a strong majority, thinking that this war must end. The hostages, the 20 or so who are still alive, the remains of those who have died, the hostages must be returned. There is a consensus within the Israeli military, active military and reservists, that this war must end. So, I conclude with where I started. Let's hope there's some serious diplomacy going on, and that the President of the United States proves willing to use the enormous leverage he has.
Libby?
Well, Fred, I think that's a very nice thought. But I don't think he will, because, you know, he's going to go see his buddy Vlad soon in Alaska, and he's an autocrat, and Netanyahu has certainly been acting like an autocrat, and Trump wants to be an autocrat. So, and that all of his movements are showing that. So I doubt the United States, or I doubt Trump will play a role in this. Witkoff might, you know, but I doubt Trump's saber-rattling will play a role in any of this. And the notion that Israel is going to occupy Gaza for a very, very long term, you know, and recreate all of it is it's very pie in the sky. I don't think Hamas is doing itself or the people it purports to represent any good, because if they were really concerned with the suffering of their people, they would have settled. They would have returned the hostages, and the conflict would have been over. But they're really not concerned with the welfare of their people.
No, absolutely not.
They're concerned with money and political power, and that's about it. Right. But what is happening in Gaza now is a humanitarian crisis, displacing another million or so, you know, who have already been displaced, getting into Gaza City and beyond that. You know, where are these people going to go? When are they going to get fed? I mean, this is not what being a Jew is about. And I've said this before. You know, it's our ethos is about healing the world. And this isn't it. This is not it. And so, you know, there are a number of rabbis who are starting to speak out. The Reform movement has spoken out. I think that in America, there's a wish for Israel to return to the democracy it once was.
I'm going to pause you right there. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll pick up right where we left off. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue the conversation and include your letters after this break. And news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we are talking about Gaza and of course what is happening with Israel and Netanyahu, President Netanyahu, doubling down on Gaza offensive after a global backlash that we continue to see. Karen, your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I'd actually like to get Libby's and Fred's view on the impact of the changing narrative among European countries about the situation in Gaza. And the narrative has always been different in developing countries. And now, of course, we've already mentioned the UN Security Council meeting. I was just checking whether in addition to France and the UK, I see Denmark, Greece and Slovenia was there, whether Germany actually was an outspoken commentator at that meeting, because even Germany, and I cannot overstate the significance of Germany's careful approach to the situation in Israel, but the meaning of that. But I don't see Germany mentioned here yet. But even China is was there too, an outspoken about the situation in Gaza. Now, what is the significance of this changing narrative among our allies and Israel's allies for the future of this conflict?
I think as a practical matter, Karen, and I kind of regret this, but I think it's true that all the government of Israel really cares about in terms of overseas relationships is the United States. Germany, I understand, has suspended at least part of its security assistance to Israel. There's no doubt that there's a trend among our European allies to to go ahead and recognize the state of Palestine. In the end, though, and Libby, I agree with you. I agree with you that Mr. Witkoff is probably doing a good job. He's certainly putting in the hours. He's doing his best. But at the end of the day, this is going to require the personal intervention of the President of the United States if there's going to be a change. I don't rule it out entirely. And it's, believe me, it's not just a matter of trying to think nice thoughts and be optimistic and pro-peace and all this. Donald Trump's closest political associate in the Middle East is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Hamad bin Salman. The Crown Prince is probably not someone who loses a lot of sleep over the humanitarian outrage that's going on in the Gaza Strip. He's a tough leader. He's very transactional, and his main motivation is to enable Saudi Arabia to achieve its Vision 2030, the diversification of the Saudi economy. But I'm sure that what he's telling his friend, Donald Trump, is, Donald, you gotta stop this. You've gotta bring it to an end. Because I've gotta tell you, 100% of my subjects believe Israel is committing genocide against the Arab residents of the Gaza Strip. And even though I'm an authoritarian, even though I'm not going to be having elections anytime soon in Saudi Arabia, I must pay attention to public opinion. So, to the extent you want me to normalize relations with Israel, join the Abraham Accords, be a key part of an American-led security architecture for the Middle East. The ability to do so is not in my hands. Bibi Netanyahu is a real, this is, you know, MBS speaking. Bibi Netanyahu is a wild card here. And Mr. President, you have to take into account whether what Mr. Netanyahu is doing is in the security interests of the United States. Because it is certainly not in the security interests of the region as a whole. So, I've spoken too much about this, but my basic bottom line, I would not rule out the possibility of President Trump intervening decisively. And as I mentioned, this is Bibi Netanyahu's big nightmare. He can defy the president and put Israel's only important foreign relationship at stake, or he can give in and perhaps watch his cabinet allies on the far right wing resign, bring down his coalition, and bring about near-term elections in Israel that may not work out in his favor.
Probably not.
So it's, yeah. if our president does intervene, it kind of puts, it may put Bibi Netanyahu in a no-win situation.
Libby?
I think it was interesting what you were saying about what Netanyahu is doing is putting Saudi Arabia at risk, everybody at risk, right? You know, the United States, our security. He's also putting at risk the security of each and every Jew in any country across the globe because all of this just foments an anti-Semitic version of anti-Zionism. It's just that simple because people don't make a distinction. And so we've seen hate crimes against Jews in this country skyrocket. We've seen other things happen in other countries. And, you know, I just don't know if Trump has the actual ability, finesse, intellectual capacity to be the one to broker a peace here. I think if Witkoff says, we're here, and I just need you to say X, Y, and Z, that's probably what will happen. I can't imagine Trump actually getting into the trenches with Bibi and negotiating this thing out. It's not a financial deal for him, and that's really all that he wants. Now, the other part of this is, it is a financial deal because he wants to build something in Saudi Arabia. But the other, you know, the other part of this is that he just doesn't have the wherewithal to be a diplomat. He doesn't know how to be a diplomat. He doesn't know how to negotiate. All he does is threaten and create a problem and then solve the problem by a further action. And this is a, what's going on in the Middle East is a little bit beyond that purview. I mean, we have to remember, I think Saudi Arabia and Israel were poised to form a relationship right before October 7th happened, right? Bibi was trying to take over the courts in Israel with his right-wing politics right before this happened. He was caught with his pants down. There's no two ways about it. And if this government fails, I think you will see a more progressive center-left leaning government take over. I hope that there's not enough of an edge with the far right to be able to mm-hmm. win Parliament.
Well, Libby, as I see it, there are two distinct stages here. Stage one is stopping the war, mm-hmm. getting the hostages home, and telling Netanyahu, you're out permanently. The shooting is stopped permanently. This does not require finesse on the part of Donald Trump. On the contrary, it requires what Trump seems to be able to do well. In other words, get on the phone with somebody and say, look, pal, you're going to do it my way or I'm going to snap your spine. Okay? That may be what's required here. The follow-on stage of reconciling Israeli security with the need for Palestinian self-determination. Yeah, this requires putting in the hours, being very, very, very creative, being empathetic, being able to listen to the central concerns of both sides if you're going to be an effective mediator. I respect your skepticism over whether President Trump, has these qualities. But then again, he can authorize someone, whether it's Steve Witkoff or somebody else, to do the mediation and to do what it takes. But the immediate challenge we all face is to end this horrific war. And what this requires of President Trump is anything but finesse.
Let's take a break. We'll pause there. We'll come back. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Karen Riedel, Fred Hoff, Libby Post, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A lot of letters this morning. We'll get to them and as many as we possibly can. And but keep them short to the point and we can get to quite a few. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to David. The war will not end as the leadership of Israel has decided that only an unconditional surrender will be accepted, no different than the Allies of World War II when German civilians were suffering and starving. The rationale for dropping the atomic bomb is the same rationale Israel is now applying. the instant media is creating an image of Israel where Hamas and groups like it all continue to perpetuate their hatred. General Sherman marched through the South and decimated it, but from that action came a lasting peace, unconditional surrender for those aggressors who continue to influence and strangle the innocent seems to be the solution that Israel is applying. And that
I would say first, I am a big unapologetic fan of General Sherman. But I would say that, you know, the difference between the Allies seeking unconditional surrender in the Second World War and Israel seeking unconditional surrender now, the difference is one of an achievable objective. You're not going to get unconditional surrender from Hamas, and the more you pursue it, the higher the pile of bodies you're going to produce. And this isn't just me. This isn't, you know, people who, you know, question Israel. No, this is coming increasingly from Israelis, from the chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces. Right? There is a growing body of opinion in Israel's security circles that the achievable military objective, beating Hamas to the point where another October 7th, 2023 is unthinkable, this has been achieved. There is no point in going any further. And I'll also add, the people of the Gaza Strip, 2 million Palestinians, are quite aware of what these Hamas criminals have done to them. And I think if there is a day after featuring Arab peacekeeping forces, featuring the Palestinian Authority playing a role in the governing of the Gaza Strip, there will be full accountability for Hamas in all of this. But perpetuating this war with the objective of killing them one by one, everyone, or forcing somebody to sign some kind of a surrender document, this is just not realistic.
Anybody else on that? We'll go to Henry's letter. It seems that the people of Gaza have been trapped between an unstoppable force, Netanyahu, and an immovable object, Hamas. At some point, an outside force is going to need to step in and break up this deadly paradox. And unfortunately, the U.S. has shown very little willingness to be that force. At this point, I feel more hope lies in other NATO countries and really any other compassionate government. What are some of these nations and what actions could they take? That is a question from Henry.
Yeah, I think the countries of the European Union, the NATO countries, all find themselves coming up short on the issue of real leverage with Israel. I'm afraid it's the United States or no one, and I regret that that's the case. But our bilateral relationship with Israel is such that it is the case, and nobody has a similar relationship, not even close.
It's true. The second biggest concentration of Jews are in this country. And, you know, there's political power behind that. You know, it's fraying that political power because we saw a lot of young progressive Jews vote for Mondami down in New York City, and that, you know, sort of a dividing line. And we just see the difference in the folks who are, oh, I don't know, baby boomers and maybe the next generation. I'm not quite sure what they're called, you know, but we grew up with the Holocaust being front and center. My father fought in the war. I've said this before. Further generations didn't have that it wasn't part of who they, how they were raised, who they were, you know, the essence of their families and all that sort of stuff. And so There's a difference, and the political power is undoubtedly shifting. There's splits among the rabbinate. There's splits among political organizations. We have J Street in the middle. We've got AIPAC on the right, and we've got Jewish Voices for Peace on the left. It's not a pretty picture. But again, the idea that we're the only ones who can manage to stop this with who's in the White House right now, if he does, he'll take victory laps from now until the end of time. And that's also part of the problem.
In my view, he's welcome to whatever victory laps he can take. He's welcome to a Nobel Peace Prize if he can end this and end it permanently.
I don't want to do anything that's going to reinforce his megalomania. That's part of it, my concern.
All right. We have a few moments. Let's go to Dan. Early in this conflict, I heard Fred state with great emphasis that the Israeli response doesn't come close to being genocide. Today, he used the term genocidal attack to describe the Hamas attack. Could you maybe clarify the use of this term?
Yeah, I think the in the case of the Hamas attack, the intent was clear. Jews were being killed because they were Jews. I believe that if 7 million Israeli Jews lined up with their arms at their sides, Hamas would have killed every single one of them. Now, there is a widespread, almost unanimous belief, I guess, in the Arab world that Israel is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. This is a view that is now, ironically, taking hold in some intellectual circles within Israel itself. My personal view is that genocide is not what is happening in the Gaza Strip. But in saying that, I don't mean to minimize what is happening in the Gaza Strip. The number of people being killed, being subjected to hunger, being subjected to medical emergencies, it is inadmissible. It's unacceptable. I have no doubt at all that war crimes and crimes against humanity have been committed by Israeli soldiers and Israeli officers. Do I believe that the intent of the Israeli government is to eliminate Palestinian Gazans as a community, as a people? No. But even if I say it's not genocide, it doesn't minimize or excuse what's actually happening on the ground.
Debate reminds me of 1994 Rwanda, where the United States got caught up on the question of whether what we're seeing is genocide in a place where 10,000 people were murdered every single day in a country of no more than 8 million people, or whether what we're seeing is genocidal acts. And this debate was the basis for preventing the United States to actually act. And so I find it ironic that we find ourselves in a place, again, where we debate terminology, whereas, as Fred clearly states, is what matters is what is happening. I mean, that's no matter what we term it to be.
Anyone else? All right. Let's go to more letters. And reminder, we welcome your panel at WAMC.org. From the New York Times, July 31st, the world's Arab countries for the first time have joined unanimously in the call for Hamas to lay down its weapons, release all hostages, and end its rule of the Gaza Strip, conditions that they said could help the establishment of a Palestinian state. The surprise declaration endorsed on Tuesday by the 22-member nations of the Arab League also condemned Hamas's October 7th attacks on Israel, which set off the devastating war in Gaza. That from Joe. Then we go to Ricky, American taxpayers send about $10.5 million per day to Israel, a modern first world country. Why do they do that?
You know, American security assistance to Israel in a major way goes back to the 1970s when the United States made the determination that Israel was a security asset for the United States of America in a very difficult part of the world. The longer this business goes on in Gaza, the more questioning there's going to be in this country, if not in the White House, but in the country generally, in Congress, over whether Israel continues to be a security asset for the United States. And as that question gets discussed and debated, I suspect the possibility of aid levels being reduced in the future will be a very real possibility.
I think we have time for one more question before we go over to a break. And let's see, this one from Norma. If Israel is, quote, fighting Hamas, why are they massacring Palestinians in the West Bank and destroying homes and farms there? Israel is genociding all Palestinians. The West has to stop supporting and excusing genocide. Western journalists must do their job and report the truth.
You know, I think you can be you can be very critical of Israeli policies, you know, without getting into the genocide business. I mean, in the Gaza Strip, in almost 2 years, roughly 60,000 Palestinians have been killed. This is 0.03% of the population. Again, even if you conclude that in technical definitional terms, this is not genocide, it still does not excuse or minimize what's happening on the ground. And I'm glad the listener mentioned the West Bank, because in the minds of Benjamin Netanyahu and his allies in government, this is the real target. The possibility of Israeli annexation goes up every day. The activities of Jewish settlers in the West Bank against Palestinian property owners is egregious, and it's either actively supported by the Israeli military or the military standing aside while it happens. So ending the war in Gaza is essential because of the deaths that are taking place every day. But we should not lose sight of the West Bank.
Fred Hoff, Libby Post, and Dr. Karen Riedel with us this morning. We welcome you. Lots of items to discuss. We'll move on to a new issue and other things when we return. We welcome your input, as always, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll take a short break, get some news in with Dave Gustina, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Fred Hoff is here, senior fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College. Ambassador, thank you very much for being here, as
my
always.
Pleasure.
Libby Post joins us, political consultant and lobbyist and associate professor of government at Dutchess County. We'll try that again. Dutchess Community College. And president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel. Thank you all for joining us this morning. We are going to move on to other topics. The big topic of the hour, although it's been the big topic over the last, last two or three days of the weekend, and that is the president becoming increasingly irked with the way that the city of Washington, D.C., is being run. I mentioned this on Friday. I look at this story and I have to say, I spent many years in Washington. I was born in Washington, D.C. I love that city very much. And it's just it's sort of surreal to see what's being said and written about it. But this is where we are at this moment. The U.S. military is preparing to activate National Guard troops in the Capitol as part of President Trump's campaign against crime there, according to an official within the administration. So the National Guard would go there and,
not sure.
Take care of the out of control crime that has threatened the city, according to the president and the administration. Mr. Trump has claimed that crime is totally out of control in Washington. This coincides with a report from city officials that came out in January that violent crime in the city was actually at a 30-year low. So there is that. President Trump is scheduled to begin speaking shortly. White House aides have distributed photos of a Truth Social post in which the president wrote that Washington, D.C. would be liberated today. The last Liberation Day went really well, so this is a new Liberation Day for the capital city. The handout also includes photos of people it says were arrested at the weekend and accused of crimes ranging from possession of narcotics to drunk driving. Now, I by no means want to minimize those illegal activities. However, I do not know. I don't think I can say this. I believe I can say this with some assuredness. What city are you going to go to where you're not going to see a certain amount, a certain amount of drunk driving and or low-level possession of narcotic arrests? Bring in the National Guard, and this is a part of the crackdown on street crime in the city. Mr. Trump had not approved any official deployment orders as of early Monday, but is expected to announce at this news conference, which is supposed to take place momentarily, that up to several hundred District of Columbia National Guardsmen will be sent to support law enforcement officers in the Capitol. The Defense Department official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity, no other details were available early Monday. And apparently a lot of this, what the Washington Post is reporting, is going to be night duty. And to reassign some FBI agents, some 120 FBI agents in Washington to nighttime patrol duties as part of the president's crackdown on the city's street crime, according to people familiar with the matter. Most of the agents will be pulled from the regular duties of the FBI's Washington field office, but it was not immediately clear if agency leaders would need to pull additional personnel from nearby cities. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, they're not these latest ideas were not meant to be made public, and yet were. So,
go ahead.
Just play this out, okay? Yes. National Guard as part of the D.C. police. National Guard then takes over the D.C. police. National Guard is then there, as Trump has always wanted, to make sure that there are no public protests. That's where this is going. That's it. That's his goal. Remember when he marched, he wanted to bring the army out to at the last term, and he marched out and held a Bible upside down in front of the Presbyterian church, in which the bishop then lambasted him for. But that's what the ultimate goal here is that people get used to seeing the National Guard as police, and then, okay, if the national government's going to take over, who's going to be, approving those marching permits, the rally permits, all of that sort of stuff? Is it going to end up being somebody in the National Guard? And then we will see no protests, or if there are protests, if he looks out the window and somebody's having an argument, he'll say, go break up the protest and arrest everybody.
So do you think it has to do primarily with the protests?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And also, let us not forget the National Guard being called out in the city of Los Angeles.
Right, right.
Then that wasn't enough, so then the Marines were called
out
after that. Karen?
Yeah, I was just going to reference Los Angeles, and of course, where to me it was astonishing that the appeals court ruled that the National Guard could be sent to a city where the mayor said they're not welcome. We're dealing with the situation. Of course, that's very much the same in Washington, D.C. But I'm going to just take a little scenic route to my argument because it gives us an opportunity to think about why Washington, D.C. is so very different, why the title plates is taxation without representation, mm-hmm. because Washington, D.C. is, of course, governed by Congress. And it's unique in that way, and it has no representation per se. So it is actually the barrier that the administration should have had in L.A. It doesn't really exist in Washington, D.C. But I said, why is the president doing that now? It certainly has nothing to do with the crime rate, which has dropped by 25%, I think even 26% within the last year. So the Mayor Bowser is doing a great job as far as I can see. My biggest concern, let me share your concern with the boots on the ground for sure, but it's like my biggest concern, where I really listened up, was the reference to homelessness,
yes.
criminals and homelessness, and this administration is quite often lumps different groups, different vulnerable groups together, and the rhetoric that is being used troubles me greatly. Homelessness will certainly not be addressed by moving the homeless out, and I am concerned about having homeless people lumped in with criminals, and we're very loose in the way we use the term criminals to begin with. Homelessness is not going to be solved by moving them out of the town. In addition to that, the president, of course, is the president of the entire nation. He's not just responsible for people in his own backyard in Washington, D.C. The idea of moving people out of Washington, D.C. as a way to clean up his own backyard is yet another aspect that is a concern to me. Homelessness is rising. Homelessness among people who really should be receiving mental health support is rising, but homelessness is not just prevalent among those who are not receiving mental health care. It's rising as well among families, and we're seeing more and more young people and children out on the street. So the way that this issue of homelessness is dealt with in the debate is deeply troubling to me.
And I just want to, before we go to Fred, I just want to mention that, you know, the president has said that homeless people must move out of Washington as he vowed to tackle crime in the city, as if the homeless were responsible for any said crime in the city, which, again, we said that has decreased. The mayor of the city pushed back against the White House, likening the American city to Baghdad in Iraq. The Republican president has also trailed, saying that he plans to make the city safer and more beautiful than it was ever before. Muriel Bowser, the mayor, we are not experiencing a crime spike. And Trump signed an order last month saying it would, they wanted to make it easier to arrest homeless people. And he had last week ordered federal law enforcement into the streets of Washington, D.C. The homeless have to move out.
Where
are they going to go?
Right.
Where are they going to go?
Well, Maryland's a Democratic state, so they can go there.
And by the way, but they shouldn't have to,
No.
If any city in this country that has a homeless population, which is many, if not all, mm-hmm. Where are they going to go? And do you have a plan prior to figure out where they're going to go and how you're going to take care of them? Because, and I'm sorry, but I just have this, I have this visual image of a big bulldozer just coming by mm-hmm. and just pushing everybody into another. And
they want to do that in an upstate town, I can tell you that. The thing is this, there's going to be more homeless because of the economy. Let's be honest. You know, there are some of us who will be sort of we'll be okay. But there's going to be plenty of people who are now living paycheck to paycheck with tariffs and everything else, skyrocketing pricing, and the cost of living going up in terms of rents and all the rest of that. More people are going to end up being homeless. And what are we going to do with that?
And what is that going to do to our economy down
That's
the road?
Right.
Because, again, I want to reference all these children who are in volatile situations.
Right.
Some of them living in shelters, others living in cars. They miss out on schooling. And what is that going to do to our economy down the road? I actually just came back from a whole month of a very cold and rainy month in Germany, where I was reminded that anyone who wants a home has a right to a home. And the home does not mean a shelter. It means an actual home. There are solutions. This is still the richest country in the world. There are solutions to the homelessness crisis, and it is in everyone's interest to address it. For the government to target the most vulnerable in society and just tell them to disappear is not a solution.
I want to get to Fred Hoff, but there's also this notion that again, that there is a correlation being made between the crime, which is at the lowest. But okay, let's say it is what it is, that the crime is connected to the number of homeless people on the streets of the city of Washington, D.C. And yeah. to Libby's earlier point, where does this end in our country?
Yeah, I suppose the connection being drawn between street crime and homelessness is something that the president calculates will appeal to his political base in this country. I have my doubts that there is anything resembling a detailed plan behind all of this. My sense is that this represents more than anything else a desire by President Trump to dominate the news cycle, something he's very good at. And I can only speculate. I have no knowledge, but it's possible that there may be some bad news coming related to the Jeffrey Epstein case. You can't rule that out. I must say, until 2018, I was working in Washington for 35 years.
Right.
There is no shortage of negative political commentary out there from Democrats, Republicans, and independents on how Washington is governed under a series of mayors. But there are problems that are capable of some degree of solution. There is a problem of crime in the district, and I realize the numbers are down significantly from where they were a few years ago. But it always struck me that the big absence in the District of Columbia, and D.C. is not alone in this, is the absence of police presence in congested areas. There is just you don't see policemen walking a beat or anything like that. And this could be a matter of numbers. So if the president wants to do something about this, he can go to Congress and get appropriations for an exponential expansion of the D.C. Police force. And the president can also request appropriations for housing, for homeless people. There are things that there are substantial, specific things that can be done. But my strong suspicion is that this is a news cycle domination operation.
I'm sorry, Libby, but. Starting with this whole idea of liberation, today the city of Washington will be liberated.
I mean, we can't also forget the fact that the big bombastic BS bill, right, cut all kinds of safety net funding, probably also for homelessness. the majority of the homeless people, or a lot of homeless people, have mental illness. Those funds have been cut. You know, so where's he going to put them? And then he's not providing any resources to provide the housing for these folks because he's cutting all of mm-hmm. those programs. So it's going to be a perfect storm.
And the other thing I wanted to add, as a former Army officer, if I were an officer in the D.C. National Guard and I'm suddenly ordered onto active duty and deployed in the streets of Washington, I'm going to be asking the same question that all these FBI agents who have been deployed onto the streets are asking: what the hell am I doing here?
Right.
What am I supposed to do?
This isn't what I
signed up for. Am I supposed to be intervening in fender benders? The absence of any evidence of prior planning for any of this suggests to me that this is kind of a spontaneous, improvisational attempt to dominate the news cycle.
Prior planning for a problem that, I mean, exists, but not to the magnitude that is being described to the American people. In a social media post on Sunday, Donald Trump has demanded homeless residents of D.C. leave the country's capital. He was being driven from the White House to his golf club in Virginia,
which we pay for,
and wrote on Truth Social during that drive, you have got to move out immediately, as if the homeless were
watching,
reading, or listening. Truth Social.
Right.
We will give you a place to stay, but far, shouty caps, from the Capitol. I assume the Capitol building and not the Capitol city, although I don't know. The post was illustrated with four photographs, all apparently taken from the president's motorcade along the route from the White House to his golf course. Two of the images showed a total of 10 tents pitched on the grass along a highway on-ramp just over a mile from the White House. The third image showed a single person sleeping on the steps of the American Institute of Pharmacy building on Constitution Avenue. The fourth image showed the line of vehicles that whisked Trump to his golf course, passing a small amount of roadside litter on the East Street Expressway near the Kennedy Center.
Yeah, I guess one place we can be sure they won't be moved to is the forthcoming Gaza Riviera Resort.
Yes, seems like a fair bet. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. We will continue and finish up our last half hour of the panel after this short break. News from the BBC. I know it's not good for the planning of the future of the show, but I would like to think that one day we could hit around 10:30 and say, oh, we're out of stories. Nothing else. Oh, we're all done.
News. Yeah. No news.
We're good.
We've managed
but
all the things of the world.
We do not have that problem, so we will continue this morning. Fred Hoff, Libby Post, and Karen Riedel with us, and we welcome you. Panel@wamc.org. In a Trump-Putin summit, which is being planned, Ukraine fears losing say over its future. This is from the New York Times. Now, apparently, the vice president in the United States is looking to and working on getting Ukraine involved in these talks, which are going to take place in the state of Alaska. But we'll see how J.D. Vance does in that regard. For nearly 3 years of the war in Ukraine, Washington's rallying cry in backing a fight against a Russian invasion was no negotiations about Ukraine without Ukraine. But when President Trump meets Vladimir Putin of Russia in Alaska on Friday, the Ukrainians will not be there, barring any last-minute invitation. And Kyiv's swift rejection of Mr. Trump's declaration that he is already negotiating with Russia over what he vaguely called land swaps with no mention of security guarantees or arms for Ukraine underscores the risks for the Ukrainians. It also carries political perils for President Trump. Ukraine's fear for these past 6 months has been that Mr. Trump's image of a, quote, peace accord is a deal struck directly between him and Mr. Putin, much as FDR, Joseph Stalin, and Winston Churchill divided up Europe at the Yalta Conference in 1945. That meeting has become synonymous with historical debates over what can go wrong when the great powers carve up the world, smaller powers suffer the consequences, and free people find themselves cast under authoritarian rule. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky himself invited such comparisons in a speech to his people hours after Trump raised the specter of deciding Ukraine's fate in a one-on-one meeting in Alaska, territory that was once part of the Russian Empire, while Mr. Putin has made clear that he regards Ukraine as rightful Russian territory dating back to the days of Peter the Great. The Russian leader has not called for the reversal of the $7.2 million sale of Alaska to the United States in 1867 during a period of financial distress for the empire. Who would like to start us off on
Happy to. I think Joe, what's important to note is that what Russia is proposing is that Ukraine recognize the Russian acquisition of Ukrainian territory in return just for a ceasefire, not the end of the war. I don't rule out the possibility or even the likelihood of Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine winding up inside Russia at the end of the day when there's a comprehensive peace deal. But to try to force territorial concessions in return only for a ceasefire shouldn't be the least bit acceptable. A ceasefire, by definition, is temporary, unless it leads to an armistice or formal peace talks. It's by definition temporary and unstable. A ceasefire normally means that the shooting stops and everybody remains in place. It doesn't recognize the territorial claims of one side or the other. It's not clear, at least to me, that President Trump understands this, and I guess there's a danger that he might accept Putin's formula for permanent territorial concessions in return for a temporary ceasefire. I think the president's goal should be a total in-place ceasefire and the beginning of Ukraine-Russia peace talks facilitated by the United States and its European allies. And I think now, more than any time since this administration took office, now's the time for Secretary of State Marco Rubio to earn his salary by ensuring that the president acts with resolve in his meeting with Putin and moves decisively to support Ukraine militarily and with sanctions if Putin declines to accept a ceasefire in place.
Karen.
First of all, I'm going to say I appreciate that President Trump has shown willingness again to get once again involved in it, because a sustainable peace agreement would benefit from the involvement of the United States, not only to ensure these security requirements that Ukraine will need to have, but also long-term involvement that will be required for true stability in Ukraine and in the region. However, I'm most pessimistic that we will see such outcome, because, of course, Ukraine will under no circumstances, and I made that very clear, and rightly so, agree to appeasement. And that is what it, of course, would be if land was swapped for ceasefire. Now, what is it that brought Putin to agree to this meeting, because he certainly isn't terribly concerned about sanctions or threats of sanctions. There were sanctions before the Biden administration. The sterner tone from President Trump has not led to the end of bombings. So why is he coming to Alaska? Why we invited an indicted war criminal to the United States? That's a debate in itself. But why is he decided to come here? Is like, I think it's a win-win situation for Putin. He can once again make the case that we're willing to negotiate. This is now in the ballpark of Ukraine to make concessions. Ukraine will not do it, and Putin is back on the world stage. He's back, invited back at the negotiation table. He will come out convincing this administration that that Russia is willing to give, that it's Ukraine's fault that a solution is not found. And that, of course, is a bizarre notion that the situation is Ukraine's fault, but it is a bizarre notion that many people on the right have bought into.
I just think that this is another piece of political theater for both of them, for Trump and Putin. Trump made his disdain for Zelensky and the Ukrainian people very clear when Zelensky came to the White House, and all they were concerned about was the fact that he wasn't in a suit, and that was insulting to them, and that he pushed back because he is there to represent his people, and he knows, you know, what that means compared to some other folks. This is just going to be the good old boys getting together, and they can say whatever they want, but if Ukraine doesn't agree to it, you know, it's not likely that it's going to happen. But we cannot forget that Putin wants to recreate the motherland, and you know, there's all, after the wall fell and the Soviet Union fell, there were all of these new nation states out of Russia, made out of the former Soviet Union, and Putin wants to recreate that, go back to that, but with his form of government, not what they had before. And so he's not going to stop. He'll say, sure, I won't take that land. I won't do this. I won't do that. And then he's going to do it. Because that's who he is. He's not going to, you can't trust this man. You can't trust either one of these guys. It's no. Just that simple.
I'm going to add that while I appreciate that the president is moving forward again or picking up on negotiations again. But we also have to remember that at least when it comes to this conflict, and like with the conflict in the Middle East, the position of our allies, the Western European states in particular, matters here. And the European states have a very different perspective on the situation in Ukraine. And they will back the Ukraine to continue pushing back on Putin for Ukraine's sake, but also Europe's sake and mm-hmm. the world's sake overall. So.
So just going back to the story about National Guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. He's placing the D.C. police under federal control. That's exactly what I was talking about. D.C. police under federal control with the National Guard and maybe the Army and the Marines. Take care of all the protesters.
Anybody? Yeah.
Just coming back to Ukraine for a moment. I think the danger here.
I would like to, and before we go back, would like to say as we are watching this this press conference that is on CNN, they are doing a fairly good job of talking because the president has come out with his numbers and charts, which show these outrageous these you know huge spikes, and then the numbers that CNN is showing from crime statistics within the district, as you know, down 49%, down 27%, down 32%, and so forth.
Those are alternative facts,
I'm just
you know,
giving a little pat on the back to CNN for live fact checking. Fred, I apologize.
Yeah, no, not at all. And back to Ukraine for a moment. I think the danger is the danger here in a one-on-one meeting, if that's what it turns out to be. Vladimir Putin is a professional. He is a professional manipulator of other human beings, and he's very, very skilled at this. He sees President Trump as someone who is susceptible to flattery and other things. And I think what he will try to do is convince the president that Russia's territorial demands, at least some of them, certainly recognition of Crimea as Russian territory, recognition of other parts of eastern Ukraine as Russian territory, trying to get the president to accept unilaterally on the part of the United States the reasonableness, the validity of those demands, in return for which Putin will indeed order a ceasefire. Okay, the danger is number one, Ukraine rejects it, and Trump and his vice president say, well, okay, fine, that is the end. No longer will the American taxpayer be chained to this war. And this will put an enormous burden on our European allies, who would have to live right next door to the consequences of all of this, and it would put Ukraine in a terrible position. So one hopes that the president will be thoroughly briefed before he heads to Alaska, and warned about the disparity of accepting permanent territorial changes in return for a temporary ceasefire. Anything permanent coming out of this crisis, this aggression, ought to be the result of a treaty of peace.
He can be briefed all day long, but he'll decide what he wants to believe and not believe. And as long as Vlad, gives him a hug and a kiss at the beginning of this whole thing and keeps flattering him, he's going to give him whatever he wants.
In fairness, I think President Trump probably would also be concerned at the potential prospect of coming back from Alaska. And being criticized, basically, as having done a job equivalent to that of Neville Chamberlain at Munich.
There was something that came in. Oh, I know. If he cedes this land to Russia, this is going to be the further unraveling of NATO, because our allies will see us as screwing them over and opening the door.
Yeah, there would be a real question what would happen if Putin, in the fullness of time, moves against Lithuania or Latvia or Poland. What would the United States do? Would the United States be willing to implement Article 5 of the NATO treaty? Or simply look the other way and say, well, the Russians have concerns of their own, and what's so great about the United States? Let them do what needs to be done.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. Our next segment, Here Comes the Sun. We'll be back right after this. For years, dermatologists and health experts have extolled the value of sunscreen to prevent skin cancer and protect people from the ultraviolet radiation of the sun. However, a growing anti-sunscreen movement has taken hold on social media, causing confusion about its benefits and alarming public health experts who say avoiding sunscreen increases long-term health risks, including cancer, by the way. Sunscreen protects the skin by either absorbing or reflecting ultraviolet rays that can cause sunburn, premature aging, and skin cancer. Most sunscreen formulas fall into the two categories, chemical and or mineral. Chemical sunscreens form a thin protective film to absorb UV radiation. They use ingredients such as, there's a whole lot of chemicals here, but I will say avobenzone and oxybenzone to name a few, to absorb UV radiation and convert it into heat before it reaches your skin. Mineral sunscreens rely on zinc oxide and titanium dioxide to physically block UV rays from reaching the skin. Now, more Americans are questioning the safety of everyday products, driven by a growing distrust in conventional health advice and that of pharmaceutical companies and federal regulators. Among them are supporters of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again movement, who have helped revive skepticism of sunscreen ingredients. Some people are also looking for natural alternatives that they say skin irritation that they have experienced from certain products has caused them to shift from conventional products. As a result, alternatives like homemade creams and mineral-based sunscreens and butters.
Well, you just fry.
It's just fry
in the sun.
Spray on a little Pam.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, girls would put baby oil on their skin, and they would get so sunburned. But this is, you know, this is the MASBA movement, Make America Sunburned Again. I mean, you know, this is like the anti-vaxxers. It's all the people saying, oh, we don't trust science, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. When you get diagnosed with melanoma, don't come crying to me because Trump has now canceled all the research contracts for cancer research.
I read to you a statement from Summer Whiteside, 31-year-old ER nurse from Wildomar, California, who said, I am definitely a MAHA mom, Make America Healthy Again mom, and voted for Trump so that RFK Jr. could get into office. After listening to his podcast on Joe Rogan, I knew he was the man for the job. On Instagram, Whiteside, who doesn't shy away from the label crunchy, posts things like beef tallow for sunburns and her preference for mineral sunscreen. Whiteside, who said she has concerns about the chemicals in sunscreen, uses long-sleeved rash guards on her kids and sunblock only on their faces. So meanwhile, you have health experts, professionals, who warn that anti-sunscreen messaging can be harmful for the public because skin cancer remains one of the most common types of cancer. According to the American Cancer Society, experts say sunscreen is one of the most effective tools for prevention. Amy Friedman, a professor and chair of dermatology at George Washington University, and said skepticism of sunscreen is nothing new. Concerns about chemical ingredients and mistrust in federal oversight resurface every now and then, often fueled by social media and wellness trends. But he said the science has remained consistent. Ultraviolet radiation is a known carcinogen. There's no debate about that. We've had decades of data showing that sunscreen plays a critical role in reducing skin cancer risk.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just it just strikes me there is so much misinformation, disinformation out there on social media. It's a real problem, and I certainly would not want to see anybody physically harmed as a result of internalizing these lies. Just to follow on with what Libby said, maybe in the end here, we're going to see a form of natural selection Were those stupid enough to follow this kind of ersatz advice are going to be the ones who suffer?
You know, I have a tween and a teen at home, and so I spend most of my time when I talk to them telling them, listen, you got to listen to experts, not opinions, because that is, of course, what social media has brought about. It's to me, the greatest risk of social media is not all the misinformation and the fake news. It really is a shift toward seeking opinions rather than expertise. And in this environment, which exists everywhere, of course, as a result of social media, we need true leadership, and we don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the result of it is it's not just the people who don't know or they're stupid. It's like it's my children who are exposed to this kind of misinformation.
Yes.
And I wish we had leadership to remind us of the significance of expertise.
Well, and of course, I mean, there have been. Movements in the past over health for years and years. I mean, the scariest thing about this is that the person who is in charge of making these policies is buying into this. I mentioned Adam Friedman a few moments ago, the professor and chair of dermatology at George Washington University, and I liked a statement that he said, which is that while beef tallow and other butters and creams are being used, coconut oil, he said, look, you don't make Tylenol or Advil in your bathtub. There's
that was gin.
Yeah, there was no way to replicate the safety testing and effectiveness of a professionally formulated sunscreen. So
you got to wonder if Ms. Whiteside is going to have a job. Here she is. She's an ER nurse, right? People come into the ER expecting an expert in emergency medicine, a nurse who knows what's what, a nurse who believes in science, and she doesn't believe in science. So it's really going to be very interesting to see if she has a job after being quoted in the Washington Post.
Well, we certainly saw that during COVID and so forth those in the medical community questioning some of the more scientific approaches, let's say.
But you know what? There's so many other things to be anti about, right? You know, fascism, things like that. We have to just focus on sunscreen. It's another little shiny object.
I'm telling you, if they do away with sunscreen,
they're not going to.
That, there goes my chance to always smell like a coconut.
Well, Joe, we'll get you some eau de coconut.
Yeah, that's fine. Even the coconut oil doesn't make you smell like a coconut quite like commercial sunscreen.
There's a song in there.
My thanks to Fred Hoff, Libby Post, Karen Riedel. Blessings to you all. We will be back with more show after this news break and a few announcements, and then we'll go to the BBC right after this.